So now it is my pleasure to welcome you to the session, Managing Gastrointestinal Complications. This morning's session will be presented by Dr. Manin. Dr. Manin is a professor of medicine in the gastro... Obviously, they should have given me this before. You're going to have to help me out on that.
Gastroenterology and hepatology.
Gastroenterology and hepatology division at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He is also the director of... Gastroenterology, you got to help me out here.
And Hepatology Clinical Research Program.
There you go, Hepatology Clinical Research Program. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Manin.
Well, thank you. Good morning. I don't know how many people were at the last sort of panel session on CVID, but it's always nice for me to hear questions that are on people's minds. That helps me sort of organize the kind of comments I'm going to give during this talk. And then one thing that's I've become aware of over the years is that people have become more and more interested in probiotics and the microbiome of the gut and things like that. So there's a section, kind of a little mini symposium on what we know about the gut microbiome and how things like antibiotics can affect it and what might be the implications for patients who get frequent antibiotics. But the focus is going to be on managing gastrointestinal complications of primary immunodeficiency. And the way I've organized this is sort of in a couple of different bullet points. Why do they actually even happen? How often do they happen? Who's at risk? What are the GI complications of primary immunodeficiency, and how can we manage and treat them? And then finally, as I alluded to, what's happening to the good bacteria in my gut after so many antibiotics? So the take-home messages today, and I really am very sincere about this, yes, some primary immunodeficiencies can clearly increase the risk for certain gut problems, but not every gut problem is due to the PID, okay? And that's important because sometimes, you can lose focus on you as a person and not as a diagnosis if we just focus on the PID, and I think it's very important that we keep that in mind. So why does PID affect the gut? Well, the gut has the highest concentration of immune cells of any organ, and obviously these conditions affect the immune system. And the gut is really the first line of defense against organisms and antigens. In fact, the gut is exposed to a large amount of microbes, and the colon and distal small intestine itself contains over 100 trillion bacteria. That's up to 4 to 5 pounds of body weight. The gut's devised an immune mechanism to actually balance its daily response as it interacts with these organisms. It has this tight epithelial barrier. It has antibody production, and it actually produces antibacterial proteins. And also, we do know that changes in the gut microbiome can be related specifically to certain types of immunodeficiencies, and also prior antibiotic treatment also changes this dramatically. So this cartoon here just sort of demonstrates parts of the immune system in the gut where from the lumen of the gut, from diet or from bacteria, naive cells hang out in these secondary lymphoid follicles, B and T cells. They get exposed to antigens that they do recognize, they mature, they go through the bloodstream, and they go back to the gut specifically where they take up residence for the rest of their lives almost. And they just wait until they see that antigen again. Yes, I apologize. You know, this microphone, it's hard to... If I bring it down here a little bit. Okay, hopefully that'll be better. Thank you for letting me know. Sorry. So I just want to point out, too, that in this histologic picture of the gut, you can also see these lymphoid follicles and all these other little blue dots which represent lymphocytes and monocytes. So there is a huge concentration of the immune system in the gut, and that's why it's affected, obviously also because it's in contact with antigens 24/7. So how often do PID-specific GI complications occur? Well, estimates vary, from either 10% in certain conditions to 100% in other conditions. It really does vary by the type of primary immunodeficiency, so that some common PIDs have very little gut problems, while some rare PIDs have frequent prominent gut problems. And to illustrate this, I made this little graph before I came down here. So on the x-axis, I have this frequency of GI complications, so from 0 to 100% of people who have a diagnosis. And then On the y-axis, if I can point to it, we have the severity of GI complications from low to high. So something like selective IgA deficiency, which is the most common primary immunodeficiency, has almost no symptoms whatsoever, okay? No complications, GI or otherwise, basically. However, something called early onset colitis is actually defined by the appearance of severe colitis, almost looks like a Crohn's disease, in newborns. So there's almost 100% penetrance rate here, and this is this IL-10 receptor defect. I have some pictures of it coming up. Now, CVID, which is fairly common, but only 5%, 5 or 10% of patients get this very severe enteropathy, okay? Similarly with CGD, about 50% will get this colitis and GI obstruction from these large granulomas, and we're actually going to focus our two cases on the CVID enteropathy and the CGD. So I have another group here called CVID GI symptoms, and at the question and answer period, there is a lot of interest about is my achalasia, is my gastric esophageal reflux, is my gallbladder symptoms due to my CVID, and we'll talk about this. One thing is, you know, I mentioned or alluded to post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome that probably could play a role in a lot of IBS-like symptoms in CVID. But, you know, it just occurred to me, too, that patients with CVID get a lot of antibiotics often and early. And there's been a lot of recognition that the eradication of H. pylori in Western society related to early antibiotic use and maybe other things in terms of sanitation, refrigerating food and things like that, that the eradication of H. pylori early has been paralleled by an increase in gastroesophageal reflux disease in general. So this could be possibly one of the reasons why people have an excess incidence of reflux disease in CVID. I just really thought about that during the discussion we're having. And then finally, two other fairly rare conditions, IPEX syndrome, that is immunodeficiency, polyendocrinopathy, enteropathy, X-linked, they all present with an enteropathy, severe malabsorption. This is because you don't have a lot of these suppressor cells that require this FOXP3 molecule to function properly. And then Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, in about 10% of patients can get a severe ulcerative colitis type inflammatory bowel disease, but it's not clear whether this is related to the actual immunodeficiency itself or a complication of the autoimmunity. So this is sort of a complex of how I think about the risk of primary immunodeficiency complications in PID. So what are the complications? Well, I group them into infections, inflammation, autoimmunity, and then cancer. So just to remind you of the anatomy of what we consider the GI tract, you have the esophagus here that serves to, as a conduit for swallow food, and the sphincter that serves as a barrier for gastric reflux. The stomach really is primary, it does start some digestion with acidification, but it really also churns the food into a liquid that's squirted into the small intestine where it can begin its real digestion with bile and pancreatic juice, and then absorbed in the small intestine. And then finally what's left over in the colon, is all the as much water as possible is reclaimed, and then obviously you eliminate the stool. Related to the anatomy, the esophagus, for instance, has particular symptoms associated with the pain on swallowing, foods or liquids getting stuck, and of course heartburn. The stomach can give people pain in the upper abdomen, a feeling of fullness, even after small meals are eaten, something we call early satiety, and then obviously be a source for vomiting. Problems with the small intestine can lead to large volume watery diarrhea, bloating, pain, and vomiting after meals, especially if there's some obstruction in the small intestine, excess gas, and obviously weight loss, because this is where all the nutrients are absorbed, so if you're not absorbing them, you're not going to be gaining any weight. And then the colon, also a complication of diarrhea, blood in the stool, feelings of urgency, or incomplete evacuation. So this is a chart, and I think these slides are going to be available to you all. Anyways, you don't have to worry about, I think, writing everything down. But, you know, at the top of the chart, we have the selective IgA deficiency, which really is really almost absolutely no concern for GI complications. CVID and CG we're going to be talking about in more detail. And then some of these less common things that really come to the fore mostly in childhood, and obviously there's a focus on stem cell transplantation, which once the immune system is restored, then the GI complications are also a thing of the past. I don't really get to see a lot of these types of patients, except perhaps if there's some graft versus host disease in the intestine as related to complication of the transplantation. So this is just a quick set of images of this fairly newly diagnosed entity of very early onset colitis in babies, where you can see, I think this just died. So you can see ulcers in the colon. You can see extension of the ulcers, almost fistula-like, almost Crohn's-like, affecting the skin around the anus. That's a picture of a surgical specimen where you see some very deep ulcers. And you can see that on the left-hand side, there's a complete truncation of the IL-10 receptor protein, so much so that in the middle panel, it doesn't even properly signal when you stimulate it. And then in the right-hand panel, you can see that when you give IL-10 to the cells, you cannot down-regulate any of the inflammatory responses, and it's this unregulated inflammatory response that leads to this colitis. But this is just a really dramatic example of a single gene defect that can lead to an immune-based GI problem. So just to go to sort of more germane things, I'm going to present two cases. These are two cases that we dealt with at NIH. This was a 45-year-old female physician, diagnosed with C of AD in medical school at age 26. She had been on IVIG since and had excellent control of her infections. At age 42, though, she had some episodic diarrhea. It usually resolved on its own, but Campylobacter was cultured several times, and it improved after targeted antibiotic therapy for the infection. But at age 44, the diarrhea became really persistent and accompanied by significant unexplained weight loss. So when we first saw this patient, the thing I always think about, and this is sort of where the infection comes in. So we know that CVID patients, they really are a heightened susceptibility to protozoan. That's a fancy word for parasitic infections and bacterial pathogens. So we think about Giardia lamblia, we think about Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, H. pylori as well, and then something called small bowel overgrowth. And I put this in all caps to remind myself to talk about this because small bowel overgrowth in our study of CVID patients at NIH is present in almost 30% of patients with chronic diarrhea. Now, this is a condition that's not exclusive to CVID. It happens in people with diabetes, poor motility, people who have anatomic disturbances in the small bowel. But what it is it's the colonic-type bacteria grow upstream, and they grow so far upstream that they begin to interfere with all the digestive processes. So you can get all the same complications of weight loss, chronic diarrhea, bloating. And it's very easy to diagnose, in a sense, by something called the hydrogen breath test, where people drink a little sugar solution, and they blow into a balloon every 20 minutes for the next 3 hours, and we measure the amount of hydrogen that they exhale. Now, the only cell in the body that can metabolize a sugar to hydrogen is a bacteria. So that we know that if the hydrogen appears within 20 or 40 minutes of ingesting it, there's bacteria high up in the GI tract where it shouldn't be. So that's a positive test. And so the simple treatment for that is what else? Antibiotics. But I do have people, particularly even older people, who I have at least two older patients who otherwise healthy, had unexplained weight loss, positive hydrogen breath tests, and now they get cycling antibiotics and they're kind of back on the road to normal bowel movements and weight gain. So it's easily recognized that we don't really understand why it happens in certain people necessarily, but it certainly happens much more frequently in CVID, so I'm always aware of that. Chronic IVIG therapy can decrease. So in the literature, you'll read something like this. Oh, it can decrease the incidence of infectious diarrhea. Well, I think this is controversial. I really don't. I've never seen this. I think there's no reason why it should. That's what people write about. Now, you know, the GI tract can also be susceptible to some of the autoimmune disease that occurs elsewhere in the body with CVID. You can get an autoimmune attack of the salivary glands, peritonitis. The atrophic gastritis is a loss of lining of the acid-producing part of the stomach, and along with that, you lose your ability to absorb B12 because the stomach does provide very important factors that are required for B12 absorption by the intestine. That leads to something called pernicious anemia. And then people also can get a chronic active hepatitis, a so-called idiopathic autoimmune hepatitis. Now, nodular lymphoid hyperplasia is something that also can affect the gut, and you remember those like little bumps of lymphoid tissue. Well, because there's a very disordered maturation of the B cell and T cell interactions, these lumps can sometimes get pretty big. Big, when I say big, I mean you can see them with the naked eye, and sometimes they can be quite multiple. This is called nodular lymphoid hyperplasia. It doesn't usually hurt, it doesn't bleed, it really doesn't do anything, but some people think it might be a focus where the increased risk of non-Hodgkin's B-cell type lymphomas can occur. However, do we screen for it routinely? No. When we see it, do we monitor it every year like we do polyps? No. We just monitor as we can because the frequency of lymphoma is really small, and so just with routine follow-up and testing that you may do, you detect any lymphoma typically. And you know, Dr. Cunningham-Rundles, who sees many more patients than I do, you know, made the point that usually the lymphomas are very low grade and treatable even if they need treatment. So this is what we're going to focus on today, the 5 to 10% of CVID patients who develop a chronic diarrhea weight loss malabsorption syndrome. It's unrelated to GI pathogens, and it's unrelated to even the best IVIG levels you've ever had in your life. So going back to our patient, she really had diarrhea, and I alluded to an absorption test called a D-xylose test. Again, this is a very simple test where you have 25 grams of D-xylose. This is a 5-carbon sugar that used to be used as like an artificial sweetener, but it doesn't require any GI digestion enzymes to be absorbed. So you drink it, and an hour later we draw your blood, and if you have a 25 milligram per deciliter level or higher, you're good to go. That's an excellent, normal absorptive capacity. Hers was reduced. Steatorrhea is a fancy word for fat in the stool. Typically, a healthy person will have no more than 6% of excreted undigested fat. She had 60. She actually required TPN for weight maintenance, and being an emergency room physician, she just admitted to herself at home when she needed it. Her stool cultures were negative, and as I mentioned, hydrogen breath test that previously had been positive in her was now negative. So we really didn't have a typical reason for why things were going wrong. However, when we did the upper endoscopy and we saw her biopsy, we had a question about flat villi during the question and answer period, and I'm sorry this isn't working, but you can see these beautiful, thin, finger-like projections of the mucosal surface in the small intestine basically serves to increase the absorptive area of the small intestine. And then on the left-hand side, her biopsies, which showed obviously they're blunted, they're not looking good. And so somebody would say, oh, this looks like celiac disease. Looks like you have celiac disease. Well, you know, there's a lot of features in that biopsy that are not consistent with celiac disease. Celiac disease, you'll see a lot of plasma cells in the lamina propria. You'll see hypertrophic crypts. You have loss of the brush border. The brush border is perfectly fine right there. And also some of the epithelial cells in the CVID patient biopsy, they have what we call apoptosis. There's a lot of unusual cell death going on, which you do not see in celiac disease. So there are a couple of features pathologically, but almost every CVID patient who's come to me with chronic diarrhea, they said I have celiac disease. Now, can you have celiac disease and CVID? Absolutely. Absolutely. They're both common enough that it's going to occur to a certain percent. The only time I've actually seen it in any measurable degree has been in a report from Ireland, the western part of Ireland, where there's actually a high rate of celiac disease and a fairly high rate of CVID. But the pitfalls in the diagnosis, as I mentioned at the question and answer period, is you cannot use antibody-based screening tests. So you have to do the HLA molecules. Now, HLA molecules are just molecules that determine what kind of antigens get presented to T cells and B cells. And so you can't have celiac disease unless you have this HLA background, this DQ2 or DQ8, either homozygous for those alleles, or you have one of DQ2 and one of DQ8 as a heterozygote. If you don't have that, if you're just heterozygous for one and everything else is normal, your risk of celiac disease is almost zero. So I really rely on this to help me. Now, do I have patients who sometimes they're homozygous for DQ2 and they have CVID? Sure. So what do? I put them on a gluten-free diet and we see what happens. Sometimes they get a lot better, and I say, thank goodness you don't have CVID enteropathy. So, you know, so there's a lot of ways to skin the cat, but you have to do it sort of methodically. So getting back to the CVID neuropathy, it's really an insidious onset. It can be kind of stuttering. People can have like short courses of diarrhea over a long period of time, and then finally just sort of becomes persistent. Unexplained weight loss. Obviously, we talked about the chronic diarrhea, usually without, almost all the time, without stool white blood cells. When we look in the stool for white blood cells, that tells me that there's kind of an ulcerating inflammatory process, like an ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, and that's not what CVID and neuropathy is. And then finally, some of these are malnutrition effects. If you're chronically malabsorbing fat, well, you're not going to have a lot of vitamins that help you absorb calcium. They're not going to help you make clotting proteins. You're not going to be absorbing vitamin B12 to give you megaloblastic anemia, and things go on and on. So these are some of the secondary complications of the malabsorption itself. So how do we manage this? Well, you know, just like we had mentioned, we do try to eliminate any treatable causes of bacterial overgrowth or positive stool cultures. But we've also started, you know, typically what I'll start with is short courses of steroids, oral prednisone, and that usually very quickly helps with the diarrhea and also with the weight loss. There are other things that are used as immunomodulators, that hydroxyquin, cyclosporine, azathioprine, that you can use short or long term, okay? We use that a lot in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Total parenteral nutrition temporarily, obviously, to maintain people's body weights and overall health. In the literature, you'll see some people using anti-TNF drugs, Remicade and Humira. And I'm also going to tell you, the thing is, there can be an attendant risk, infectious risk with these drugs. So I typically will use them when we've sort of eliminated or we've sort of gone through a number of these other medications, because I'm sort of the school where I say we identify where the risks are, but we do everything we can to manage the risks because it's just a necessary therapy to try. But, you know, when we were at NIH, we did a big study with CVID patients who actually had enteropathy versus those that didn't. And we found that when we looked at the cells from biopsies and what inflammatory chemicals they were making, all the CVID patients with GI symptoms were making very high levels of IL-12 and interferon gamma. They were not making any IL-23 or 17. And the reason that's of interest is that all of them are elevated in Crohn's disease. We've never seen a disease where just the 12 and gamma are kind of elevated in and of themselves. So it gives you an opportunity maybe for more targeted therapy. And actually, there were antibodies made by companies specifically for interferon gamma and specifically for IL-12. But because they failed in other diseases, they were never developed. However, there is a drug now on the market. It's being used for psoriasis called Stelara. This is an antibody that recognizes both IL-12 and 23. And there's actually, right now at NIH, there's, based on our data, there's a clinical trial that's open using Stelara in CVID neuropathy. So I just want to mention, if you know anybody, just to get the word out. And you can always just go on clinicaltrials.gov, www.clinicaltrials.gov, put in CVID, and you can get that. So anyway, so I think that there are going to be expanding opportunities to treat this, which actually is a fairly devastating complication, to be honest. So we actually had an opportunity at the time partnering with a company that made an experimental drug, which was an oral medication that blocked cytokine activity. They said it was kind of specific for 12 and 23, but it was actually kind of acted on a lot of different cytokines. But to make a long story short, a lot of the pretreatment symptoms were pretty well relieved, including her diarrhea, her absorption normalized, her steatorrhea really reduced. She was able to maintain her weight on an unrestricted diet. And in fact, when we went back and looked at her biopsies, we could actually see regrowth of villi. Okay, and this is what I was alluding to in that other question and answer. Someone asked, could you ever do something to regrow villi? And so my answer is, well, if you can block the cytokines that are driving the destruction of the villi, yes, you can. You know, just as an aside, if you give a mouse either the IL-12 or interferon gamma acutely, you get acute small intestinal damage, just sort of like we see. So we know that there's a connection in an animal model, and this seems to be connected here. So I think that the Stellara trial at NIH is very exciting. So in terms of conclusion for the enteropathy, we know that the malabsorption is due to diffuse small intestinal involvement. You can have responses to steroids and anti-inflammatory strategies. Symptoms are associated with the excess IL-12 and gamma production, but that more studies needed on the root cause and the effectiveness of targeted therapy against cytokines, which should be going on at this time. So just to kind of move on to CGD, we also had a large group of patients that Dr. Harry Malik and Steve Holland were following, and there was a patient, 20-year-old white female, diagnosed at age 4 after recurrent Pseudomonas pneumonia, staphylococcal subcutaneous abscesses, but at age 22 she developed bloody diarrhea, inflammatory bowel disease was diagnosed. And to be honest with you, the inflammatory bowel disease looks like the worst Crohn's disease I've ever seen in my life in these patients. And you know, we're talking about anywhere, you know, from 40 to 50% of patients, so it's a fairly big attack rate. And she had a perirectal abscess that was surgically drained, and she had a current active rectovaginal fistula because the inflammation is what we call transmural. It doesn't just affect the lining, it affects the whole thickness of the bowel wall, so that when that happens, the inflammation on the outside then can stick to other things like the skin, the bladder, the vagina, and cause these fistulas, which obviously really impact quality of life. So this was her severe colitis, and I think even to the untrained eye, you could see the ulcers linear and stellate in areas. And on the biopsies, the normal colon I put here on the right-hand side, but you can see in her biopsies, you have these areas of really big inflammatory granulomata. Now, this would be like a small one. They sometimes grow to the size that are so big, they actually obstruct things like the esophagus, the small intestine, the emptying of the stomach. So this can be a problem in addition to having things like the fistulas and then causing ulcerations in the bowel. As part of the GI complications, you know, these patients are subject also to liver abscesses. The abscesses that occur with some of the fistulas can lead to sepsis. Patients have presented with dental abscesses as well. But then, distinct from infections, just the inflammatory components, I alluded to the fact that these granulomatas get big, they can interfere with the motility of the esophagus, blocking stomach emptying, small bowel obstruction, and obviously we saw the example of the colitis. So in terms of managing this complication, we've actually turned a lot to conventional inflammatory bowel disease therapies, including mesalamine, something you may know by, Pentasa or Asacol, those types of drugs. Steroids are used for brief periods. Antibiotics and steroids can be used for the gastric outlet obstruction. Any of these obstructive lesions, the steroids actually helps to shrink the granulomata temporarily. We also had found that drugs that were used to sort of stimulate the polymorphic nuclear cells, and these are the cells that really are affected by the defect that causes CGD. So by stimulating them with these growth factors, we found that the colitis actually responded. And in fact, because of that, I used G-CSF in Crohn's disease in a trial. And these compounds do have immune benefits beyond what they do to stimulate, say, the polymorphic nuclear cells. People have tried HLA-identical cord blood stem cell transplants, and once, like I said, if you cure the immunodeficiency, then you basically block also the GI complications. Any kind of abscesses need drainage, and the thing about the liver abscesses, sometimes they don't form very well, so a lot of times we will just focus on using antibiotics, and Steve Holland is someone who also gives patients interferon gamma actually to help stimulate an immune response for these abscesses. Remicade, Humira have also been used because it acts so much like a Crohn's disease, and those drugs have been effective. And then there's a new report of this other drug, anakinra. It also targets another inflammatory cytokine. This drug had been in use for these familial periodic fever, like familial Mediterranean fever, some other things, inflammatory conditions that are affect the inflammasome, which is an important part of the immune response. But anakinra, in an animal model, and then in a brief study for CGD patients really had remarkable effects. So there are some, again, with ongoing work, there's emerging drugs that can help fairly significantly with some of these complications. So in terms of gastrointestinal cancers, my take-home message is that I think that the risk is not as much as people have reported in the past. Although the rate is increased compared to a normal population, in the normal population it's sort of already low, so now you're just a little bit more than already low. Okay, so it's not a really big risk. In fact, it's not such a risk that we actually encourage additional screening for gastric cancer or colon cancer. Now, clearly, if people have something called pernicious anemia and gastric atrophy, we may do upper endoscopies more frequently, but just like we do in someone who doesn't have PID, looking for certain types of polyps and tumors that can occur in that setting. But probably the biggest thing that we see in the GI tract is the appearance of B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphomas and the so-called mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue lymphomas. And, you know, like I said, as Dr. Cunningham-Rundle said, she thinks that that's overblown. Her view of seeing patients who are referred to a major cancer center kind of skewed the numbers to think that the risk was higher than it is. And she also made the point, too, that these are generally low-grade tumors at the time, and even if they require chemotherapy, people with primary immunodeficiency, CVID in particular, can do very well with any kind of regimented chemotherapy. Okay, so this is sort of the last section. Just want to talk about the gut microbiome. So, you know, I was lucky enough to be part of the Human Microbiome Project, and that sort of stimulated my interest in this, particularly in a population of patients where they're really exposed to a lot of antibiotics, and I really hadn't thought about it much before. But it's estimated that there's 100 trillion bacteria in the gut, as I said before, and actually there's about 100 billion bacteria that flow from the mouth into the stomach every day, just from all the oral, because, the mouth is filthy, and it's got a lot of organs, and you swallow them all the time, plus whatever else you're getting in with water and food all day long. And the gut is subject to environmental factors, the diet, antibiotics, other drugs, but also the gut microbiome is subject to host genetic factors. So, for instance, like in twin studies, identical twins do not have identical microbiomes, but they're more related to each other than, for instance, they are to their parents. And they're much more related to each other than they are to a stranger. But they're not identical. But that just shows you that there are genetic factors that shape the microbiome. Okay? Interestingly enough, that in animals, mouse models in particular, when you knock out certain genes, and we do this in inflammatory bowel disease to understand what types of genes play roles in the diseases, but when you knock out some of these immune-related genes, and animals can develop all of a sudden a spontaneous colitis. And in fact, the microbiome that develops can actually transfer that colitis to a normal wild-type mouse. So there's something about that microbiome that we call colitogenic that happened in the setting of just that gene defect. So just the interaction of a group of bacteria with a genetic, uniquely genetic host can influence its makeup. And I think that's important because, thinking about primary immunodeficiency and certain gene defects that cause a disease, no one's ever really understood, does it change the microbiome that people have? And we do know that so-called dysbiosis, when you have a change in the microbiome that looks different from a healthy one, that can be associated with certain diseases. So, when we study the bacteria, we kind of break them down from the kingdom to species, and it's a little different from what we learned in biology, where when you take the animal kingdom and then you look at all the animals that have spinal cords, and out of them take all the animals' spinal cords who are mammals, and then after them all the mammals who eat meat, and then all the mammals who eat meat who are cats, and then who are little cats and big cats, and then finally you end up with tabby. So we've made this classification scheme of what things look like, these phenotypes, but we can't do that with bacteria. They're too small, it's too tedious. So what we do is we do genetic fingerprinting. So we've decided to use the genetic code of a specific gene, this ribosomal RNA, 16S ribosomal RNA gene, and we sequence that in a stool sample, and you get all the collections, and you know, obviously takes big computing and sequencing capacity. But how we break it up now is by what's the genetic match. So, for instance, in a phylum, all the ones that have 75% match are grouped together in a phylum. But then you get up to about 97%, and that would define a species. So that's how we look at these things now. And these are two pictures from the Human Microbiome Project that I think are very easy to understand once I explain them. So the colors are related to different phyla of bacteria. So that green is for Firmicutes, the blue is for the Bacteroidetes, and then the others you can see. But every one of those spikes represents a single patient who donated a stool sample. 242 spontaneously passed stools were sequenced. So my question to you is, does everybody look like they're the same? No. Everybody's completely different, okay? Completely different. And this is just at the phylum level. We haven't even gone down to other. So this is just an example, because the question was from this study, do healthy people have the same composition of their microbiome? And the answer here, if you look at this, is no. So what we did was we looked at this another way. We looked at, okay, so of all the bacteria who are in the stool, what genes do those bacteria have? And so this is called the metagenome. So you can see now the same thing. Every one of those little lines from top to bottom is a single patient. You can see that though they have very different bacterial compositions, they have very similar gene compositions. And those genes are responsible for things like carbohydrate metabolism, making energy through ATP, all these metabolic pathways. So the healthy person might not share the same bacterial composition, but they certainly share the same functional composition. So this was sort of one of the big take-home messages from this study. And in fact, left-hand side, this is just another way to show this. This is the blue represents, I think, Firmicutes, but this is stool passed by an infant from day 6 all the way to about a year and a half. And so while the baby's being breastfed, you get a lot of these Firmicutes that have a lot of the organisms that actually are important for metabolizing milk proteins. But then when they become weaned to solid food, you know, even by like 1 year, they have almost what looks like a healthy adult microbiome, where they have, you know, more Bacteroidetes and Firmicutes. And so that early on, this is obviously in the absence of any antibiotic exposure, that's you very early on establish your sort of adult microbiome. Now, how long does that last? Does that last your lifetime? Well, a study that they did was they took individuals and over 300 months they took serial stool samples, and they wanted to see, well, how stable is that initial microbiome? Well, they did a lot of stool samples up in like the first, you know, the first couple of years, and there was a drop off where it sort of leveled off to about 60 and 70% of stability. So it lasts a very long time. So without any external perturbations, it really can last a long time. So it's established early and probably is fairly stable. So what are the effects of antibiotics? So On the right-hand side, this is a study where they took three healthy people and gave them 2 5-day trials of ciprofloxacin. And then they looked at the composition of their microbiota. So during the 5 days, you can see the spikes that go down. They really lose a lot of bacteria and a lot of what we call diversity in the microbiome. And we know that diversity has always been associated with disease states. But then it sort of rebounds, and it kind of comes back. The diversity is about the same. But then after the second one, it's sometimes a little harder to get back to baseline. And in fact, this phenomenon hasn't been studied well, and this is one of the studies that's always quoted and looked at because it was done very meticulously. But, you know, I think it's a fair consensus that people understand that if people have repeated antibiotics, that they completely change their microbiota and they never go back to what they had established as children or adults before antibiotics. So that's a fact. But what's the consequence of that? We really don't know. The influences to consider are the diet. We know that changing the diet, if you focused on just feeding somebody yogurt, you would see an increase in genes from the bacteria that deal with, you know, digesting milk oligosaccharides. drug exposure is not just antibiotics. There are other drugs that can either affecting the pH or affecting the immune response can also change the microbiome. Disease states, like I study Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and we know that there's a quote-unquote dysbiosis. We know that there's almost a flip in the ratio. These patients with active disease have many more Bacteroidetes than they do Firmicutes. And then obviously the genetic background, which hasn't been proven yet in humans, but it's clearly been proven in animal models. You know, and the effects of the gut microbiome act at the gut and beyond. We do know that some of the dysbiosis can induce obesity and metabolic syndrome. We have very good data showing that kids who are exposed to antibiotics early in life are a much higher risk for allergic asthma. And then there's an autoimmune disease because of so-called missing microbiota hypothesis. There's so much exposure to antibiotics, not even just given for treatments, but also in our food supply, that there's certain organisms, in particular H. pylori, that sort of disappeared somewhat from Western countries, and yet there's been a big increase in autoimmune disease, and suggesting that that played a role in the immune protection of some of these infections. There's more kind of edgy work showing that, you know, some of the microbiota can actually metabolize and produce neurotransmitters. So there's a big push to look at how it affects mood and central nervous system diseases. And then certain diets, when they're metabolized by the gut, can produce compounds that actually cause the gut to be leaky and enhance translocation of bacteria and bacterial products into the bloodstream, causing chronic inflammatory responses. And then post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome, where it's become more clear that after certain types of bacterial gastroenteritis, people have long-term, even up to 6 years later, an irritable bowel syndrome like, altered bowel movements, abdominal pain, cramps, and bloating. It's not inflammatory, but it's certainly symptomatic. So in terms of approaches to maintaining and restoring the order, we sometimes talk about probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, fecal transplant, and more highly targeted antibiotics for C. diff. So I just want to say about probiotics, we really have absolutely no data to recommend a type of bacteria, a group of bacteria that are beneficial for health. No matter what Dan and Yogurt says or what anybody says, we just don't have the data. And I tell patients all the time, I said, I would feel like a fraud if I insisted that you took probiotics. I wouldn't even know what to recommend. And you know, probiotics are not drugs. They're foodstuffs, so they're completely unregulated, and that's why all these claims can be made on television, radio, and print without any repercussions. Prebiotics, though, kind of interesting. A prebiotic is basically a nutritional constituent like fiber that actually enhances the growth and metabolism of certain bacteria. And what I do recommend is I recommend that people do have a good high fiber diet, and I think just getting it from fruits and vegetables and whole grains is perfectly fine. You don't have to take supplements for it. Symbiotics are when people sometimes give pro and prebiotics together to help a probiotic. Now, this is mostly in experimental models, probiotic outgrow. And fecal transplant, this is a very good treatment for people who have recurrent C. difficile infection as a complication of repeated antibiotics. I've used it in multiple settings in my IBD patients. There was a nice report of using fecal transplant in post-transplant, heavily immunosuppressed patients, and it was perfectly fine and safe. I would really not hesitate to use it in a PID patient who had, recurrent refractory C. diff colitis, but would I use it as a primary treatment you felt like you had to change your microbiome? Absolutely not. Because, again, we don't know, based on your genetic background, that we know there's no core microbiome that we can give to somebody right now. We know what kinds of genes we'd like to see there, but we don't know what mix of bacteria is going to be important to do that. Okay, so the last slide, I think in terms of the complications of PID, the most important thing is maintaining awareness of risk and possible PID-specific complications. I always have to remind myself, is that not all GI symptoms are due to the PID, so routine, thorough workup is always valuable. And that there are still opportunities to study the effect of the gut microbiome in PID as it relates to the GI and non-GI symptoms. All right, so that was a lot of information. I'm happy to answer questions. And, you know, I know it's sort of late, but I'm happy to stay here afterwards to answer how many questions. Yeah.